Imagine a platform where some of Britain's biggest stars have the opportunity to reflect and celebrate their biggest professional accomplishments in a lovely, relaxed, chatty space. Since 2016, Josh Barry's Beyond the Title has celebrated the great and good of entertainment, from showbiz legends to rising stars and everyone in between, who have each provided an insight into their remarkable careers in the public eye. So join Josh and the team as another significant figure in entertainment shares their unique anecdotes and stories exclusively on Beyond the Title.
Former Minister for Employment and MP for Maidstone and the Weald from 1987 to 2010, writer, author and television personality Anne Widdecombe remains one of the most colourful characters in the history of British politics, known for her forthright views and eccentric approach, which became a gift for satirical jesting. After Whitehall, Widdecombe embraced her new level of fame and appeared on a host of light entertainment shows from Strictly Come Dancing to Celebrity Fit Club. An ardent Brexiteer, she joined Nigel Farage's controversial Brexit party in 2019 and became member of the European Parliament for South West England until 2020. I caught up with one of the most formidable figures in public life to talk politics, pasodobles, and her recollections on an unprecedented career in the media. Ladies and gentlemen, Miss Anne Widdecombe.
Welcome to Beyond the Title, Anne. You're one of the most recognisable figures in the history of British politics. So by way of an introduction, maybe you can tell us what it was about growing up in the 50s and 60s which made you want to make a difference to society.
Well, I mean, growing up in the 50s was a wonderful experience because, of course, it was a time when family life was very cohesive. We all grew up just accepting that our parents were going to stay together. It never occurred to us that, you know, there would be any family breakup. That just didn't happen. It was not a time of great prosperity, certainly. I mean, I can remember the rationing that was still in force after the Second World War. My family went out to Singapore in 1953. We came back in 56. And by the time we came back, pretty well all rationing had gone. But then we immediately had the Suez crisis and we had petrol rationing. So it wasn't a prosperous society at the time, but it was a very stable and cohesive one. And there were very clear standards. And in a way, it was the age of the hypocrite, because in private people broke the standards, but at least society knew what it was signed up to. So it was a good, secure time to grow up. The 60s, of course, if you were young in the 60s, you were blessed above all the things you really were, because it was a wonderful time to be young. Sudden boom and burst of colour, absolute burst of colour. You know, the 50s were very grey. I can remember it, you know, boys wore grey shirts and grey jerseys. And everything was terribly grey. And then the 60s came along, this huge burst of colour, the psychedelic craze that everybody went through towards the end of the 60s, when we all dressed in very bright competing colours. And of course, it was also a prosperous time. The economy took off. The war was well and truly behind us. Rationing was a distant memory. And there was a greater freedom. Society was going through its sort of social revolution. And it was a massively good time to be young. You know, I had the Beatles. I had the best of that. And again, the 70s. You know, I think I was born at exactly the right time, because the 70s came along. And when I graduated in the 70s, it was still, and that was in 1972, it was still absolutely lawful, Josh. I mean, lawful for an employer to advertise a job with two rates of pay underneath, one for men and one for women. Because we were still at the stage then of assuming that the man's role was to be the breadwinner and therefore he had to be paid more. And then right in the middle of the 60s, along came the Equality Act, and that ceased to be lawful. And I was, you know, only a couple of years into the labour market at that point. And quite suddenly I was operating in a way, you know, that women before me had never operated. So it was very good. So I don't think I wanted particularly to change society. What I did want to do was to keep it on a certain course, because when I was coming to political consciousness, it was the height of the Cold War. And the world was divided into two very sharp, conflicting political ideologies. And there was a real contest for the future of the world based on a conflict between capitalism and communism. But of course, in Western democracies, it wasn't so much communism as socialism. But it was real socialism, Josh. It was red in blood and claw. It wasn't Tony Blair's New Labour. And so there was an enormous divide, and everybody knew which side of that divide they were on. They knew it with their head, with their heart, with their gut. They knew it. And so politics was quite intense in those days. And you never had people on doorsteps saying to you, doesn't make any difference, you're all the same. Young people were particularly engaged. And youth politics was very, very vibrant. So, as I say, I knew which side of the argument I was on. And that was the fight that I wanted to fight.
So winning your seat at the 1987 general election for your constituency of Maidstone and the Weald, you were elected into the final phase of Margaret Thatcher's government. What do you think was the secret to her political success? And as a woman, how do you think she paved the way for gender equality in British politics?
Well, I think the mere fact of having a woman prime minister, you know, did volumes, because she was there as prime minister for 11 years. Therefore, an entire generation, from the moment that it could make any sense of the news at all, that it was old enough to understand the news, until the moment that it was old enough to cast its first vote, that generation knew nothing except a woman prime minister. And you would never convince that generation that there was anything odd about a woman being in charge, because it was what they had grown up with. Mm. So I think that alone made an enormous difference. I think the secret of Thatcher's success was that she knew what she wanted to do and she went for it. You know, she absolutely was determined. I was an enormous admirer of Margaret Thatcher. She was also lucky on a couple of occasions. You know, most politicians get where they get with a mixture of ability and luck. And her luckiest moment came in a very unlucky moment for in many ways, when the Falklands War arrived at the time that it did. Now, you never rejoice in a war, ever. But if it had come at any other time, it would have just been, you know, something that we had to deal with. Coming as it did in 1983, when unemployment was high and the Thatcher economic reforms were really biting on people, it was generally postulated, we forget this, that she could lose that election, you know, 1983. Instead of which, the Falklands War came along, she did all the right things, and there was a massive explosion of support for her, particularly as the then leader of the Labour Party was preaching unilateral disarmament and all the rest of it. So I'm not saying that the war was lucky, no war is ever lucky, but the timing of the war saved her from what could have been an electoral defeat. And then she went from strength to strength, and there was nothing to stop her thereafter until she got too remote, I think. She didn't understand that the poll tax was as unpopular as it was. She thought this was something you could just ride out, as she had ridden out a lot of other unpopular measures. It wasn't.
Becoming Minister for Employment in John Major's cabinet of the early 90s, in what ways do you think the consumerism of the 1980s helped to heal the financial turmoil of the 70s? And what were the vital lessons that the government learned from that period?
Oh, I think the enterprise economy that Thatcher stimulated was vital. I mean, there was an enormous cultural change in the 80s, really big cultural change, which was this. Until then, the managers had come in at 10 o'clock in the morning. You know, it was the workers who'd turn up at 6. The managers came in at 10. The managers had a sort of a fairly easy lifestyle, and they went home again at 6. With the Thatcher revolution and the enterprise revolution, it was the managers you'd see on the train at 6 in the morning. Suddenly, everybody was very focused. People believed they could be millionaires by the time they were 30. A lot of people got carried away, but a lot of other people just took advantage of the atmosphere that there was at the time. And yes, I mean, Thatcher certainly cleared up the huge economic mess that the 1970s had left us with. And that was largely down to her will, down to turning the nation into an enterprise economy. We had been known as the sick man of Europe. Suddenly, we were the envy of Europe. And that was Thatcher's doing. But the cultural change can't be emphasised enough. The enterprise culture, the I can do this, rather than I must go and find a job for somebody to employ me. You know, if you were an Oxford graduate, suddenly it was not a matter of shame if you set up a window cleaning business, for example. Now that, you know, that was a huge change, and I think it's often underestimated.
The ever-changing political landscape occupies a significant part of popular culture, and the two enjoy a symbiotic relationship, which is obviously complicated by the influence of the media. How significant is this relationship to breaking down some of the societal barriers between the electorate and the political elite?
If anything, I think it's gone too far. In the 60s, you had the age of deference, which was suddenly punctured by the arrival on the scene of That Was the Week That Was. And that was the turning point. And suddenly politicians were no longer treated with unthinking deference. However, it's now moved to something just as dangerous, which is unthinking contempt. And I think it's having a massive impact, Josh, on the quality of people in Parliament. Now, you've always had some very outstanding members of Parliament and some absolutely shockingly bad ones. But it's the quality of the mass in between that determines how able a parliament is. And when I came into Parliament in 87, it was still very, very high quality. I mean, in our own intake, on the Labour side, there was a brain surgeon. On our side, there was a consultant gynaecologist. We took it for granted that Parliament recruited at that level. Now, you would be very hard put today looking around Parliament to see many such people. There are some, certainly, but to see many such people. And I think that is partly due to the, not just the death of deference, but the rise of contempt. The profession is not respected. People, if you're a politician, now, we were always lampooned, we were always cartooned, we were always teased by phrases like, oh, well, that's as much worth as a politician's promise or whatever. Yes, but there was an underlying respect for the position and for the job that had to be done. And, you know, we used to do all night sittings and goodness knows what else. So if you're a serious person now and you're 50, 55, had a big record of success in the outside world, have something to offer. You're not new to it all. You have something to offer. Such a person once would have elected Parliament as the first choice of the way to give something back, public service through Parliament. Now such a person looks at it and thinks, do I really want to join a profession where every bus ticket is held up to ridicule? Do I really want to join a profession where the media invade not only my private life, but family life? Do I really want to join a profession that nobody actually has very much time for? And his answer or her answer will be no. And they will go and give back via some different form of public service. We're losing quality in Parliament.
In 2000, the late, great Victoria Wood chose to end her BBC One Christmas show with an elaborate song and dance number as a bizarre tribute to you. What was your reaction to this?
Oh, I enjoyed it hugely. Now, Victoria Wood is one of only two comedians who rang me up before taking me off on television, who rang me up to say what they were going to do and was I okay with it. Victoria Wood was one, and the other one was Ken Dodd. He wanted to crack a joke on television about how he was once my toy boy. And he asked if I objected to this, and I said, no, just as long as people do understand it's a joke. They were very unusual in that they rang up and checked. But I loved the skit. Victoria had asked me to go along to the show, but I thought that was a stage too far. I was on the front bench at the time, you know, all sorts of issues of dignity, etc., which wouldn't matter if I weren't on the front bench. So I said, no, I couldn't go. But actually, when I saw it, I rather wished I had.
That kind of leads us on to the next question. So being part of a serving cabinet naturally puts you in the spotlight for criticism and in some cases lampooning. How much pressure did you feel not to create a media frenzy? And do you think there's such a thing as negative press?
There is such a thing as negative press. I mean, I've been subject to it from time to time, so I know that there is such a thing as negative press. And yes, one of the reasons why you always hear people saying, why don't politicians answer the question? You know, they get the why can't you give a straight answer to a straight question? Well, the answer is because the media doesn't bat straight. And so when you're sitting there answering questions, you're the whole time asking yourself, what is the headline? What is the car crash? that this interviewer is hoping to get. And you foresee the headline and you try and avoid that. I mean, I always used to say rather sarcastically that if I'd stood on the coast near my Kentish constituency and looked out to sea and said, oh, look, you can see France today. Some journalists would have written that up as Europe comes closer, says Widdicombe. You know, that's the sort of thing you're watching for the whole time. And so it's like a joust. The politician is trying to foresee the headline and avoid it. The interviewer is trying to get that headline. Now, that is why politicians don't always answer very straightforwardly. There was one occasion when I really thought I'd given a hostage to fortune, and I hadn't, because they were so surprised that I answered straightforwardly. And I'd just been appointed Shadow Health Secretary by William Hague, literally just, and I just came out of his office and out onto Smith Square from what was then Conservative Central Office. So 5 minutes I'd been Shadow Health Secretary. And some journalist thrust a microphone under my nose and said, what is your health policy, Miss Widdicombe? And I said, I haven't a clue. And I was expecting banner headlines, haven't a clue, says Widdicombe. But in fact, that didn't happen because I think they appreciated it.
Retiring from politics in 2010 coincided with the ongoing fascination with celebrity culture and reality television. To what extent has your continuous celebrity status surprised you? And how do you think this subtle change in the way we view politicians has altered entertainment as a whole?
Certainly, I would never have predicted what was going to happen. If anybody had said to me, as I was getting ready to leave Westminster, which I did in the early summer of that year, if anybody had said to me, as I was getting ready to leave, well, Anne, this is how it's going to go. You're going to be dancing for 3 months on primetime television. Then you're going to be touring the whole of the United Kingdom and the Irish Republic, for that matter, in a live dance show with Craig Revel Horwood. Then you'll be in pantomime. And oh, by the way, you're also going to be on at the Royal Opera House. I would have said to that person, lie down and have an aspirin. Because it was so unlikely. What I thought was going to happen was I was going to be on Strictly, which I thought would be good fun to do. But I was going to be on Strictly for about 3 weeks, you know, then I'd be eliminated because I can't dance. I've no sense of rhythm. I'm tone deaf. So I'd be out after 3 weeks and therefore be very well paid for doing very little. Then I was going to retire to Dartmoor. On Dartmoor, I was going to obtain dogs and I was going to walk dogs and write novels, and it was going to be a very peaceful existence. And Strictly sent the whole thing in a completely different direction. And I think it's a question of being open to opportunities, and none of it was ever planned. But when it came along, you know, I grabbed it with both hands and did it. So I think, does it make a difference to public perception of politicians? I suspect the answer is no. It made a difference to the way the public perceived me, because everybody stepped to me, who stopped me in the street, oh, never realised you were like that. And I said, well, thank God, because at the dispatch box, it would have been deeply inappropriate. So I'm glad you didn't realise that I could do that sort of thing. And I don't think it's changed attitudes. I'm not convinced that Matt Hancock did himself much good in the jungle. I do think Ed Balls did wonderfully on Strictly. But the crucial thing about Ed and myself is we'd both retired. We'd retired. You know, we'd left politics. We weren't compromising the dignity or the time commitment of an MP. We weren't compromising any of that because I'd retired and he'd been defeated. The big question with Ed, I think, was always if he was going to clown about on Strictly, as he did, and everybody enjoyed it hugely, would he then seek to come back into serious politics? That was the question. I mean, I was never going to do that, or I thought I wasn't. I then ended up doing it with Brexit, but I hadn't thought I was going to ever come back into politics. So it was safe. You know, it was safe to behave in a different way.
Have I Got News For You has often been the Achilles heel for many politicians, but how do you think your no-nonsense attitude helped to soften the caustic tone of Paul Merton and Ian Hislop?
Well, the first one that I did, and I did it twice, and at the time there were only two women who'd been asked to do it twice. The other was Emily Maitlis, make of that what you will. So the first time was very successful. The first time was great. I enjoyed it. I hadn't expected to enjoy it. I had right up to the last minute thought to myself, well, why am I doing this? You know, maybe I shouldn't be doing this. But I really enjoyed it and it went well. The second time was a near disaster. I mean, it wasn't a complete disaster, but it wasn't enjoyable. It didn't go well. It wasn't successful. And that was largely down to Jimmy Carr, who just kept up a stream of vulgarity throughout the programme. But interestingly, Paul Merton now goes round, and when he does his audiences saying that I was the worst chairman ever. Now, I could find lots of people who were much worse than me. He did acknowledge that the first time went well. He did acknowledge that. But then he said I was the worst ever. And I thought, well, why is he saying this? And then I found out when I read an account that he'd actually elaborated on it. And apparently I told him off and he resented this. So he must be terribly prickly individual.
So we briefly spoke about Strictly just a moment ago, but upon signing up to the show, did you have any reservations?
Oh, yes, I had reservations, but as I say, I wasn't expecting it to last long. Yes, I did have reservations, quite strong reservations. I said right from the start there were things I wouldn't do. You know, I wouldn't wear any clothing I considered immodest. I wouldn't carry out any moves I considered immodest. But they were just so glad to have me because, you know, I was an old woman and I was a politician and that combination, you know, was very unusual. So reservations disappeared, I think, in week two, probably. Week one, I still had reservations. Week two, they disappeared. I think you can see the same process for Ed Balls as well. He was very stiff during week one, during the waltz. And I was actually saying aloud to my screen, come on, Ed, you know, look as if you're enjoying it. Week two, it was a different Ed altogether.
In the past decade, the political landscape has faced some of its biggest challenges in living memory. When David Cameron became Prime Minister in 2010, he promised an EU referendum. What was your initial reaction to this? And why do you think it was the right time to question our position within the EU?
Well, I can tell you why David Cameron thought it was the right time. He wanted to lance the boil. I mean, Europe had been a tremendous source of division. Now, there are two views on Europe in the Conservative Party. There are two views on Europe in the Labour Party. And there were two views on Europe in the country. But it was very, very difficult trying to control a party where one faction was always pulling against the other. And so David Cameron thought, let's get rid of the argument. Let's have a referendum. The reason he decided that was he thought he was going to win. He thought Remain would win. And the reason he thought that was he was living in the metropolitan bubble. You know, he was living in a certain class. He was living in a certain wealth group. And he had the attitudes of what is often caricatured as the metropolitan elite. He didn't know what they were thinking up in places like, you know, Sheffield and Liverpool and places, some of the poorer parts of the country. He had no idea what they were thinking. And so he was going to win. You know, it was a foregone conclusion he was going to win. As a matter of fact, I thought they'd probably win as well. But that was what, I don't think he would have had that referendum if he'd known he was going to lose, or he might have fought it in a different way. So if you say, why was it the right time? It was politically, in Cameron's view at the time, the right way to get rid of the divisions. You know, there will be a decision and that will be it. Well, there was a decision and that wasn't it, because they then spent years trying to thwart it.
GB News continues to divide opinion with its right-wing bias and links to council culture. As a political commentator and former politician, why do you think there's a place for this kind of platform in today's broadcasting landscape?
Oh, I mean, I cheered the advent of both GB News and Talk TV. And I appear regularly on both. Because they don't do cancel culture. You know, they don't do anything except free speech. And you can say more or less what you like. And you can't say anything criminal, but you can say more or less what you like on GB News. They won't stop you saying it. And as Mark Dolan always says in his introduction to his programme on a Sunday night, as he always says, we don't do boring. You know, it doesn't matter what your view is, but we don't do boring. And I think, I mean, it's still quite tame in some ways. I mean, I would have liked to see, for example, a debate between one of the more sane people who have doubts about the vaccines. I'm not talking about the crazy anti-vaxxers, but one of the more sane people who've got doubts about them, and scientists with exactly the opposite view. And I'd like to see a similar debate on climate change. But you don't get that so much. I have seen very, very brief confrontations, but they're too short, you know, for what are massive subjects. So I'd like to see a bit more of that. But yeah, I think GB News is filling a gap, because until GB News came along, all we had in this country was a left-wing media. You know, the BBC couldn't believe the Brexit result. They couldn't believe it, because they're also part of this sort of metropolitan bubble. And they didn't know what people were thinking in other parts of the country. And bluntly, I don't think they cared much until it rose up and smacked them on the nose with the referendum result.
So beyond politics, you've turned your hand to non-fiction, penning a whole repertoire of thought-provoking novels. How has this helped to offer another side to your public persona, and what were you able to draw from your experiences as a politician, which helped you to refine the characters and situations being discussed?
I'd always wanted to write Josh. It wasn't a flash in the pan. I'd been writing in an amateurish fashion since I was in my early teens. So I always wanted to write, but I was very, very occupied with other things. And when I got into Parliament, I had no free time at all. I didn't write a word. I didn't even write an unfinished short story. Didn't even write the first paragraph of anything while I was in Parliament, because it was the age of the all-night sitting. And at weekends, I was in the constituency. When I wasn't doing anything, I was exhausted and I slept. So I didn't actually have time to take whatever talent I had forward. Then what happened was that Conservative Party was defeated in 97, and I spent a year on the back benches because of my attack on Michael Howard, that I couldn't go into the shadow cabinet. And suddenly this whole mass of time was released back to me, time that had been spent in doing the red boxes, doing the ministerial meetings, reading policy documents for them, etc., etc. Suddenly it had all gone, and I was back to having my backbench activities. But because Tony Blair abolished the all-night sittings, not only was I back to being a backbencher, but a backbencher with much more time. And so I thought, right, this is it. If I don't write now, I'll never write. So the result of that first one was The Clematis Tree. And then the following year, I published An Act of Treachery. And then there was a two-year gap, and then I did An Act of Peace, which was a sequel to An Act of Treachery, and Father Figure. Now, interestingly enough, Father Figure was the one that did least well in sales, but is still flying off library shelves, because it deals with a problem that is now coming very much to the fore. It's a sort of Fathers for Justice type novel, and it looks at the issue of men who are unwillingly separated from their children. And I still get a lot of correspondence on that now. When I left Parliament, so all that was done while I was still in Parliament. People often think I wrote when I left, but didn't. I wrote while I was there. Then when I left, I wrote an autobiography. I wrote a rather silly, entirely trivial novel on Strictly Come Dancing. You know, it was a detective story called The Dancing Detective. And I wrote a desperately serious book on penance, you know, our modern take on penance. I've got 7 books out, but 4 of them were written while I was still in Parliament.
Looking back at your career, what's your proudest achievement?
Well, you know, every time somebody asks me, obviously I'm going to say whatever part I played in getting Brexit, I'm going to say that. But if you lay aside the big policies for a moment, and there were lots of policies that I was very proud of, my most memorable moment probably came not in any front bench capacity. I was a minister at the time, but I was acting solely as a constituency MP when I got one of my constituents out of jail in Morocco. By which I mean I got him released. I didn't spring him from jail in Morocco. But by the time his wife came to see me, he'd been convicted, he'd been sentenced, he'd lost his appeal. And he was doing 9 years in a Moroccan jail for crime that not even the Moroccans really believed he'd committed. And my initial reaction was to think, well, I can't do anything about this. I mean, I can't intervene in the system of justice in this country, let alone somebody else's. Anyway, I went through all the motions with the embassies. I got where I expected to get, which was nowhere. And then as the last throw of a dice that I was convinced was irretrievably loaded against me, I went out to Morocco. I saw the King's Counsellor, the Justice Minister, the Interior Minister, anybody else I could think of. And to cut a very long story short, the moment did come when I was able to ring up his wife and say, John's out, he's with the ambassador, he'll be home in 48 hours. And her reaction when she finally believed what I was saying to her, told me why it was that I'd become an MP. And I think the sad thing is this, on both sides of the House of Commons and in all parties, the big parties and the little tiny ones, most MPs can point to such moments when, because they were where they were and did what they did, they didn't make a drop of difference to the nation. They didn't make a trickle of difference to their constituency, but they made a tidal wave of difference to an individual family. And yet, people think, this is the sad thing, people think we're lazy, sleazy, and in it for ourselves.
So, what's next for Anne Widdecombe?
Haven't a clue. Really haven't a clue. I never know until the telephone rings. I wouldn't have predicted Strictly. I most emphatically would not have predicted Big Brother. I don't know. The telephone may not ring, and I may finally get some dogs and write books and wander on Dartmoor. So the telephone may never ring again, but at the moment I doubt it.
Thank you very much to our wonderful guest for being the subject of another Beyond the Title episode. If you like this, why not browse the website and see if there's anything else you like? We're now on Spotify, iTunes, YouTube, SoundCloud, Apple Music, and Amazon Music. Everywhere, quite frankly. Don't forget to like our Facebook page to receive updates on forthcoming interviews, and please do give this podcast a little share. Not in a shoop-shoop song kind of way, you understand, although that's probably quite welcome. Thanks again. Hopefully see you next time. From all of us here, goodbye.